Part of the problem, of course, is that the first three, gospel, salvation, the righteousness of God, were all represented by overheads or handouts, whereas I simply talked about faith and didn't have any handouts or anything like that. So that's part of the problem. You might check with someone else and see what their notes say about that. Pardon?
I have some ideas down in my notes.
The term, of course, is defined in the context there. That is, it's to be defined not simply by looking up the doctrine of faith, but by defining it in context. Stephen.
Hey, John, is that...
Mm-hmm.
Okay, number 11. I have a lot of stuff in my handwritten notes, but I couldn't identify exactly where you were pointing in the notes.
In the handwritten notes, that's... And, of course, there are some things in there that do relate to handouts or overheads. Well, that you have handouts or overheads. Some of it does depend on, as you say, the written notes. That is, your written notes. That's one you have to put together. I would suggest in preparation for number 11, since all three lists have numbers 7 and 11, that you go through that in preparation and take each phrase and ask yourself, what does this mean? How can I explain this? Look at the words that are used and ask yourself, what do I have to get hold of in terms of definitions, in terms of explanations? Go through that passage, run through it once, and just see what's necessary. Now, we have just one more session this Friday, so if something turns up in that, if you get a chance to look at that and run through it, then maybe we can address that further. John?
Yeah, a question about the reading. We hand this in with the final, at the final, the reading page?
Yeah, it's immaterial when you hand it in. You can put it in my mailbox anytime. Well, before summer. Yeah, but you can hand it in at the final or turn it into my box, whatever's convenient for you. The way it was set up originally in the handout right at the beginning, on the first page on completion of assignments, it says all reading assignments are to be completed by the last day of classes, Friday, May 18th. Written notification of such completion should be made at that time. Except for extensions granted by the Faculty Committee on Variances, no work will be accepted after midnight of the last day of final examinations. But as far as when you hand in that sheet, you can do it Friday, you can do it some other time, or at the final, whatever. That's not important when you hand the sheet in. Other questions that I can't answer? Okay. Looking back now to the formal doctrine of sanctification, we've noted that sanctification is a work of God's grace, and that it begins with regeneration, that it's based on our union with Christ and with the benefits of his redemption, that it is brought about by the agency of the indwelling Spirit of Christ, that it is effected or brought about by means of the Word of God, and that it is conditioned on the response of obedient faith to the revealed will of God addressed to man's obedience. Or another way of saying that is the law of God. the law of God is the will of God addressed to man's obedience in any dispensation. That's a broader conception of law of God. Obviously, that does not mean the law of Moses, which is one codification of the law of God for a particular time period. And on pages 152 and 153, there are a number of scriptures that speak to that particular point. Obedient faith to the revealed will of God addressed to man's obedience. Faith that works by love. I had occasion to mention before a detail, but now let me expand it just a bit. In the formula of Concord, which was an attempt, as you know, to get the Lutheran and the Reformed strands of the outcomes of the Reformation together, or at least a little closer together than they were, in the formula of Concord, there are three uses of the law. We don't use it quite that way today, that term uses. We'd probably say functions, three functions of the law. Or we might even say part of it, at least, purposes of the law. Three purposes, because see, if it functions that way, it's obviously God's purpose that it function that way. So you could say it either way, functions, purposes. Uses, of course, means the way that we use it, the way we look at it, the way we observe it. And so that's not wrong either. But the three uses of the law, they spelled out. Sündenregel, Sündenspiegel, und Lebensregel. Of course, regel, in this case, means simply a restraint to sin. It has to do more with the public, the civic sphere. It's what we would sometimes speak of today as deterrent, the deterring effect of law. There's been a considerable upswell of criticism of the deterrent effect of law in our country, made by various groups who see no deterrent effect whatsoever. And yet, curiously enough, whenever social problems are mentioned, like for instance, this morning there was a report about deterring drunken driving, and one of the most effective deterrents was suspension of licenses. That's a real deterrent. Now, of course, it doesn't deter the socially irresponsible drinker. Doesn't deter those people, but it does deter those who are socially responsible, who respond to various pressures and sanctions and so forth, and that's the great majority. The deterrent effect of the law, it's a restraint, it holds back sin, Sündenregel. The second one, Sündenspiegel, Spiegel is a mirror. A famous German newspaper is called Der Spiegel. There used to be newspapers here in this country that were called the Daily Mirror or something of that sort. So it shows us our sin. Not only tells us what sin is, but in the Pauline usage, it shows us sin in ourselves. It uncovers sin in us. So it both tells us what sin is, and it shows us that we are sinners. Sündenspiegel, that's the second purpose or function or use of the law. The third use, they particularly stressed because it was controverted at the time. Lebensregel. A regel is a rule. Leben, of course, is life. It's a rule of life. It's given to us so that we might guide our lives, so that we might know how to live righteously before God. How to pattern our lives, Lebensregel. And in that larger sense, I'm using the term law of God, as Lebensregel, larger sense in connection with sanctification. It's a rule of life. Now, I sympathize with, not entirely, but partly, with the older harsh denunciations of the law as being inimical to a grace concept of sanctification, or justification for that matter. And I sympathize partly with that. It was felt that we have nothing to do with the Mosaic law. But sometimes they didn't even specify that. They just said we have nothing to do with law, period. And left it blank. Didn't even qualify it. The Christian has nothing to do with law. Or statements like Christ is the end of the law. Not specifying Mosaic law, but just end of the law, period. Of course, that carried to its extreme opens the gate for situation ethics, no question. Because if there are no rules, if there are no standards, no principles to guide our conduct, then you've got to make them up, or the community makes them up, or something like that. And we're still in the backwash of some of that teaching. It's this third use that I'm referring to here in the quotation of these particular scriptures. Now, you might say, well, wait a minute. When you look, for instance, at Romans 13, 8 through 10, and if you look at James chapter 2, and if you look at Galatians chapter 5, if you look at those things, you know, it's pretty hard to claw away from the idea that at least the Ten Commandments are being referred to there. Certainly the Old Testament, certainly expressions within the Mosaic law. Romans 13, owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. And then he explains what law he's talking about. You shall not covet, commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. If there's any other commandment, it's summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Love, therefore, is the fulfillment of the law. And we're commanded to love. Love is the fulfillment of the law. It's very interesting. Sometimes love has been set in opposition to law when love is the very thing that the law commands. Very curious. The law, in sum, commands that we shall love God with all of our hearts, and that we shall love our neighbors as ourselves. That's what the law commands. And yet it does appear in the Mosaic legislation. And I think you can properly ask the question, the principles enunciated in the Ten Commandments, were they binding from Adam to Moses? Are they still binding today? It's an interesting question. You have to at least raise that issue. And in James chapter 2, it quotes the summary of the second table of the law. The second table of the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. If you're fulfilling that royal law, law of the kingdom, then you're doing well. But if you show partiality, you're committing sin. And then, again, so that we are not mistaken as to what he's talking about, he says, for he who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not commit murder. So again, reference to the table, the second table of the Ten Commandments. And then down in Galatians chapter 5, where he speaks of being called to freedom, he says, but through love, serve one another. Don't use freedom as a license for the indulgence of the flesh. Through love, serve one another. Now, once again, you would think that freedom is opposed to service. And you'd think again that love is opposed to law. And yet, here, through love, serve one another, for the whole law is fulfilled in one word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Again, a summary of the second table of the law. Now, see, that raises some problem issues as soon as you recognize those three scriptures at least. And, of course, Christ's statements in the Gospels concerning the summary of the two tables of the law, where both Christ says it and other people say it, and he pronounces that correct. You've got to do something with that. If you say the Christian has nothing to do with the law is dead for the Christian, you've got to specify what you're talking about there. You can't simply leave that as a blanket statement, otherwise you run up against these kinds of verses in the New Testament. You notice that I tried to say something at the bottom of 153 and the top of page 154 in terms of grace principle and law principle. I spoke there of obedient faith in the Spirit under the grace principle. And on top of page 154, disobedient unbelief or obedience in the flesh under the law principle. Now, what is meant by under the grace principle and under the law principle? Remember that when we talked about being under law or under grace, and when we mentioned, perhaps not specifically enough or explicitly enough, a distinction between doing things in the spirit and doing things in the flesh, those expressions are sometimes used, in fact they're used popularly. The suggestion was made that doing something under the law is doing it for myself. And we can combine under the law with under the law principle and doing it in the flesh. We can combine all that and say obeying God under the law principle in the flesh means to do it in my own strength and to do it for my own ends or purposes, and to secure my own glory, under the law principle and in the flesh. Do it in my own strength, do it for my own ends, my own goals and purposes, and to do it for my own glory. Whereas I would suggest that doing it under the grace principle, that is, in the Spirit, that it means to do it by the enablement that God provides in His strength, in other words, and to do it for His purposes, His goals, which is another way of saying according to His will, doing His will, that is, opposing my will to God's will and choosing God's will, not my will, but yours be done, and to do it for His glory. I would suggest that as a distinction between operating under the law principle in the flesh and operating under the grace principle in the Spirit. Now, once you have that sorted out, if that sounds reasonable, once you have that sorted out, that is, to do something under the law principle in the flesh, doing it in your own strength, that is, by your own resources, purely your own resources, cut off, as it were, from God, doing it for your own objectives and purposes, and doing it for your own glory, and doing something under the grace principle in the Spirit, that is, doing something by His enablement, His power, and doing it for His purposes and His ends, and doing it for His glory, then you can start talking about doing the will of God, that is, obeying the law of God addressed to us today. What is the will of God for us today in this dispensation? You can talk about doing the will of God either in the flesh or in the Spirit. It's possible to do the will of God under the law principle in the flesh. That is, you can combine that. You can say, hey, that's possible to do that. It's not desirable, but it's possible to do that. On the other hand, it's possible to do the will of God under the grace principle and in the Spirit. And that's desirable. That is what is commended to us. I think personally that a lot of the polemic against the third use of the law, Lebensregel, I think that polemic fears that believers are going to go back under the law and do things according to the flesh. I think that's the fear. And I think that fear can be relieved if this distinction is explained. Rather than simply throw the law out and then leave the field open for whatever principles or rules that you make up as you go along, or obey some evangelical leader or something when he sets up the rules and then you obey those. Or the evangelical community in terms of consensus. So if we can buy into this idea that the will of God addressed to our obedience is the law of God for us in this dispensation, and that we can do the will of God, we can obey the will of God under the grace principle and in the Spirit, we can do that. In fact, that is what is commended to us. Then I think we can bring back a conception of an objective standard of the will of God, an objective standard, and begin to rebuild so that we can rebuild Christian personal ethics and Christian social ethics. But then we have a theoretical foundation and a platform from which to build. The other way, there's no basis, there's no ground, there's no foundation. There's no platform. You make it up as you go along. Somebody says, I believe this is wrong. Why do you believe it's wrong? Not because it's contrary to the will of God addressed to our obedience, but perhaps because of bad effects, or perhaps because so-and-so says it's wrong, or because there's a consensus among believers that it's wrong and we shouldn't do it, therefore. Very weak stands. All of those are very weak. So I would suggest this distinction be maintained so that you can talk about obedient faith. You can talk about, as I've suggested here on page 152, that progressive subjective sanctification is conditioned on the response of obedient faith to the revealed will of God addressed to man's obedience. So there's a very real part that obedient faith under the grace principle in the Spirit, a very real part that plays in sanctification, in the ongoing process of becoming more and more like Christ, the ongoing process of being delivered more and more from the power of sin, and more to the power of holiness. There's a very real part that can play. Bill.
The struggle with this issue of in the Spirit and in the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
I struggle with it because there's
okay.
Because we've got to base something.
Yeah.
And, you know, what is that?
Well, someone will immediately say, what is that? It's simple. Believe on Christ and love one another. That's it. That's the whole sum.
But the thing that it is, what the law of hell does is exactly what I mean.
Ah, very good. Very good.
Define that. I mean, if you need that for people to figure out on their own, I mean, you're just asking for a whole bunch of trouble. And
yeah.
God didn't do that.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, what I struggle with is we are called to obedience. And I did that in in my flesh, that is, this body, this mortal body, is the vehicle in which faith is expressed and in which obedience is executed.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem...
Using flesh in the physical rather than the ethical sense.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
And I understand there's a difference.
Right.
I understand that Paul makes that difference.
Right.
But I really get terribly disturbed with trying to make in the spirit something that is ethereal, undefinable, but that isn't carefully defined. Because then, if it isn't carefully defined, I don't see how we can make it work where people can put it on the street where they live.
Okay. That's fair enough. Part of the problem is, of course, that we have made a strong disjunctive even in the terms, in the flesh and in the spirit, which seems to suggest a body-spirit disjunctive or a body-soul disjunctive, which it doesn't at all in this context. And therefore, many Christians are afraid of using the vehicle, pressing them into the service of God, lest they be doing something in the flesh.
That's exactly. But what other vehicle is there?
There isn't any other. So that when we say doing something under the grace principle in the spirit, obviously, then, we have to make it a little more sophisticated. We have to nuance it a little more. So if we say, doing it in the strength and the resources that God provides, we're not talking about the enabling apart from our physical bodies and our minds and our abilities and gifts, but with them and through them. So we have to keep those married together. But then when you get into where God's purpose is, that gets in a matter of intention, intent, motivation, purpose. So you are dealing with something internally, and there you have to say something about doing it in accordance with God's revealed will, and that draws you back to Scripture. And then the third thing, doing it for God's glory, that's very much a matter of intent or purpose. And that gets to be the most inward of the three, probably, because you can't read what's going on unless you see some expression, what's going on in a person as to whether that person is doing things for the glory of God or for his own glory. That's very inward. You can say things about it, but it's hard to test it and to see it and examine it. I think you're right, though. We need to keep those together. Well, I wanted to say that so that we could say something about doing the will of God as revealed to us in terms of sanctification. As, for example, when I referred the other day to 2 Peter and chapter 1 and what is given to us there in terms of an exhortation by Peter that in our faith we are to apply all diligence to really work at it. And in our faith to supply moral excellence and knowledge and self-control and perseverance and godliness and brotherly kindness and Christian love. These are qualities of character which we are to add and supply and extend and develop. And that means that we have to recognize that we have a responsibility in this, and it means that we have to start working at it and practicing those things, so that we develop those character qualities in us. It means we have to make ourselves a project. We have to make of ourselves a project and work on ourselves so as to develop into the kinds of godly, Christ-like persons that we know God is calling us to be. And sometimes I think we have the idea that God works on us and we work on others. We need to work on ourselves. We need to help ourselves in terms of adding these qualities in our character which express themselves in our conduct. And that really gets down to some very practical things. When I went through that series in 2 Peter chapter 1, one of the things that really stuck out like a sore thumb was the element of patience. And that was something that I became painfully cognizant of when both my wife and my children mentioned it in connection with some expressions of impatience when I was driving. And well, I'm sure none of you have those problems, but it's a curious thing. But as Christians, we sometimes cut out certain areas of our lives as far as sanctification. And those areas are outside of that that area that we're supposed to be working on. We leave those areas because, well, maybe indulgently, we leave them there because maybe we don't feel we can overcome them and probably can't. By our own efforts, purely apart from God's help. Although some people have overcome some things even naturally, in a remarkable fashion. Those are areas that we need to bring under the control of God's Spirit and God's will. I don't know what the area is in your life, or areas, but I'm sure you can, without too much thought, think of areas that need to be brought under God's sanctifying influences so that you can rise to new levels of sanctification. But it must be done, again, using it the way I suggested, not in the flesh, but under the law, according to the law of principle. That's a problem that you strike in the New Testament, again and again, especially in Paul. And it's a problem that many, many theologians have and Bible scholars with the whole concept of law. We somehow have to extricate ourselves and put ourselves back into a more sound position vis-a-vis law. Now, number 7, subjective sanctification culminates in perfection. Some points are made here, 3 in number. Subjective sanctification never complete or entire in this life. Conflict between the innate sin principle and the new principle of righteousness imparted in regeneration is inevitable and normal. By normal, I don't mean it is a norm, a standard. I don't mean that. Don't confuse it. It's like the confusion between rational and rationalistic. I'm not saying that it is a norm, that it is desirable. I'm not saying that that's the standard. But it is normal in the sense that it is the common experience of believers. And thirdly, at death or at Christ's coming, for those who are alive, the moral nature of the believer is made perfect. Now, as soon as you say things like that is, as soon as you say things like, it's never complete or entire in this life, and at death or at Christ's coming, perfection occurs, you start getting into some views of perfectionism. And on pages 156 through 159, I've laid out some views with some diagrams. And the diagrams need some explanation. They look something like the heart diagram that I put up for Romans 7, but they're a little more sophisticated, in that there are elements that weren't on that diagram. That was a sort of a gross picture without sophistication. Now, you notice I've labeled them Roman Catholic view, the view of Charles Grandison Finney, the view of John and Charles Wesley, a two-nature view, and then a proposed view with no name attached. The Roman Catholic view, we need to say a word about that. In the Roman Catholic view, the higher and lower aspects of man's nature are set in contrast to each other. The spiritual part of man, the mind, is higher. The carnal part of man, the body, is lower. By the way, that was true at creation. See, that's part of what man is. And the question of which part gains the ascendancy determines this view's conception of man's status vis-a-vis sinfulness and holiness at any given stage. So even before the fall, you have higher and lower parts. You have mind and you have body. And the mind is the higher and the body is the lower. Even before the fall. Now, you notice in the diagram, there is a little crown over top the supposed to be I there, the personality, the ego in the non-technical sense. And then you have colored in attributes to the right, and you have non-colored in attributes to the left. Now, those dark attributes are supposed to be sinful qualities. And those on the left, those clear ones, are supposed to be good qualities. Okay? They're supposed to represent characteristics or qualities of a person. There you're talking about the moral nature of a person, obviously. The crown over the top of the eye is what is referred to by in the text by the gift of original righteousness. That crown represents the gift of original righteousness. At creation, man was given a gift of original righteousness, a donum super additum, a gift that was added on top of man's nature. And so, you see, the arrow is a strong tendency in the direction of goodness. So that arrow represents the direction or tendency of the individual. In other words, the mind prevails over the body. The spirit prevails over the flesh. Bill?
Can they have to view that even before the fall?
Not as sinful, but as being a possible occasion of sin. A possible occasion of sin. And concupiscence, sexual sin, is very powerful as a concept in Roman Catholic theology. So, even before the fall, the ascendancy of the mind over the flesh represents a tilting of the personality toward good. Whereas if the flesh had gained ascendancy over the spirit or the mind, that would have been a fall. And that's exactly what happened at the fall. The one gained ascendancy over the other. It wasn't that the flesh was sinful, but that it was an occasion to sin. I know that that raises some problems, but that's the way it's set up. Stephen?
One of those things is that if, in fact, the righteous aspect of nature doesn't prevail, then how could the lower nature ever gain ascendancy?
That's a problem with all views. How could a man who was holy sin. That's a problem with all views.
Well, yeah, except in the scripture it seems that man was made with choice. And that's what makes sin
horrible. That's true in a Roman Catholic view also.
But if it's just a matter of your nature gaining ascendancy and it has a tendency to gain substance, then I think it weakens the seriousness of sin.
Well, as long as the donum super additum was there, man had sufficient power to always make correct choices. Roman Catholic theology does emphasize strongly free choice. Yeah. In the first stage, before the fall, you have this tipped in the direction of goodness. In the second stage, man has lost the donum super additum. He's lost the gift of original righteousness, and he's gained a strong tendency downward toward evil. Now he's characterized by the flesh prevailing over the spirit, or the flesh over the mind, the body over the mind. The lower nature, the lower passions control this individual. Because the yielding to the lower nature is really what constitutes sin. It's by choice, but but the yielding to the lower nature constitutes sin. Therefore, when Roman Catholic married couples, when they have sex, the justification for that is only that they can produce children. And so in that, see, even though it's in a sense a yielding to the lower nature, yet there's a justification of it if their intention is to have children. Without the intention of having children, it's purely a yielding to the lower nature. And therefore you can't bring in any contraceptive. You see, that you can't bring in a contraceptive because that's just a indulgence of the lower nature. And that's why the Roman Catholic Church takes such a strong position against the use of contraceptives, even by married couples. It's a very interesting conception. And it arises out of this, right at the beginning, this lower, higher nature and this yielding of the higher to the lower, which constitutes sin. Notice in the third stage, after regeneration, man through the sacrament of baptism, that's when man is regenerated, gains the gift of sanctifying grace. I tried to make a little different kind of a crown there. See, instead of the original righteousness, this is a sanctifying grace crown. And that tips him in the direction of goodness once more. In the fourth stage, man is entirely freed from all tendencies toward evil, even though he still retains his higher and lower powers following resurrection. Some human beings have gained this stage in this life. Yeah. Saints who are really very, very holy. Not just saints who are sort of holy and in association with whom two miracles have been proven, but saints who are very, very holy. Mary, for example. Yeah, Mary would be one. No. I suspect so, yeah. Stephen.
Would you say that this is this element of Roman Catholicism is put on
to some degree, yeah. Neoplatonism, yeah. Yes. And unfortunately, it crept in through Augustine. Yeah, unfortunately. There's so much good that can be said about Augustine that this is a problem. As you know, Roman Catholicism teaches that a person receives this gift of sanctifying grace at baptism, can lose it through mortal sin, but regain it through penance. We went through that, I think, once before. Question, Bill.
They believe that
Yes, as a possibility. That's right. As a possibility. Yes. No. Questions on the Roman Catholic? David.
What is the first house called?
I don't know that I've found any specific name attached to it. It's not the same as beatific vision. I can't call it that because that's not really what it is. I don't know that I've seen a name given to it. It might be called confirmed sanctifying grace, but that's a made-up term. I haven't seen that term. It's definitely different from the first one. Yes. And you see, I made it bigger than the other little one there. Again, just an attempt at symbolism.
But that is how it is.
Oh, yes, I know. That's Stephen.
Do you think that there are many elements in our evangelical view that are similar to that when it comes to the Platonic? We tend to see Christian sanctification as part of a war between the flesh and the whole debate we're having right now, the carnal Christian, mm-hmm. lordship salvation.
Yes. There are elements, yes. There are elements. The debate varies according to the orientation on this question, as we'll see, but from group to group, and sometimes from individual to individual, but there are elements of that here. Other questions on the Roman Catholic view? It's a fairly straightforward view. It's fairly easy to understand once you catch the basic principles of it. Gwen?
I have one question about the question of sanctification and how would they work with
Yes. I fail to find that emphasis in Roman Catholic writings. The grace is already given in baptism, so every baptized Roman Catholic already has grace. Now, he can improve that grace. That is, he can develop the Christian graces and the virtues. But again, I don't find the emphasis on grace as aid or assistance if I may call it grace versus works sense there. It all seems to be a works principle that's operative in all of that. But of course you can say, but the grace is already given at baptism, so, you know, it's all grace. Yes. Right. You may grow in graces and virtues. Yeah, sure. You may become a better person, but the grace has once been given.
So okay. It's an interesting concept for me. Is so many of the pro-lifers and the active Catholics that are what we would call spirit killed are very. I'm wondering how they work with the.
I don't either. I don't know how a number of the charismatics make, you know, consistent rapprochement with their own system of doctrine and get away with it. I quite frankly don't know how that works. Not, generally speaking, the Roman Catholic hierarchy, through its priesthood, has not pressed the people. And that's been their general approach. They've been very tolerant, very lenient, very broad-minded. They haven't pressed people. You've got to make a decision this way or that way. You know, they say, well, we're big enough, you know, to encompass all shades of belief and so on. As long as they remain in the Roman Catholic Church, we can accept almost, not quite everything, but almost everything. Although the Pope came down on liberation theology rather strongly when he visited Latin America, but still. And although he's come down pretty heavily on some of the radical liberals in Europe, like Edward Skillebakes, and some of you heard about Father Curran here in Chicago, and order for him to cease teaching in theology and so forth. So sometimes there are things like that that occur, but that's for very radical cases. Charles G. Finney, a classic. But before we start Charles Finney, perhaps we ought to take a break. Okay?